Welcome to Innovate and React. You might have heard about bacteria making chemicals before, like insulin, but probably less about typical fine chemicals or building blocks for the chemical industry. So this episode will be about how microorganisms and biotechnologies can turn methanol into value chemicals. I'm very excited to have Dr. Ronja Rappold, the co-founder of Teno Bioworks, on the show today. Hi, Ronja. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, maybe let's start with what brought you to research in biotechnologies.
Yeah, actually, that goes back to high school times, like when you are at this decision of what you want to study. And back then, I really loved all natural sciences, so biology, chemistry, mm-hmm. and physics. So I really looked for a university program where I could learn more in all three of them. And then I found biotechnology, more specifically molecular biotechnology.
Okay, yeah. For me, it was the same. I also liked all the natural sciences. And then, yeah, I went for chemistry. But yeah, let's focus on the biotechnologies. Maybe to also introduce the topic a bit, what is biotechnologies and what is it used for usually?
Yeah, so in general, it is the use of living organisms, biological systems, or cells to manufacture products that we need. So you can recruit microscopic factories like bacteria, yeast, fungi to actually work for us and produce things that we want to have produced. And maybe to give a little bit more of a broader spectrum, so it can be very ancient, from wild yeast that we use for fermentation for beer and wine since many
that everyone knows, yeah.
To very modern approaches where we use advanced genetic engineering tools to really fine-tune and edit the genomes very precisely to produce, as you mentioned in the introduction, life-saving drugs such as insulin.
Yeah, that's I found when I heard about this the first time that, well, we need insulin, but it's a very complicated molecule, so we cannot easily do it, but our body can produce it. So why not let's train basically bacteria to do it? It's very fascinating.
Yeah, I think that is one of the superpowers of biotechnology, because we have enzymes that have very specific functions and can do very specific tasks, and no matter how complex they are. So producing very complex molecules isn't a problem if you find or you can design an enzyme to do exactly that.
And they are super efficient, I guess.
They are.
Molecular catalyst researcher, I was always a bit jealous of the efficiency that you can reach at low temperatures with those enzymes, like the perfect catalyst.
Yeah, it is like this low temperature, ambient pressures, all of this are great advantages that the biotechnology has for production over chemical routes.
Mm-hmm. And an example maybe for a basic process that is used, except for the insulin?
Yeah, there is a few great examples. Maybe one that is also on industrial scale is what Genomatica did over the last years. They successfully adapted or engineered the bacterium to produce 1.4 butanediol, which is used to produce synthetic fiber, and they do that from sugar. So they have built a plant in the US that produces more than 60,000 tons per year, fully biotechnologically now.
So that can turn into this fine chemical. But
exactly.
Yeah, when talking about sugar, that's the same with all the bioethanol. It's like a crop that could theoretically also be food for then the conversion into chemicals or fuels. So the be that we are independent of the fossil fuels because we don't need the crude oil to make these chemicals.
Yeah, definitely. So I think this is a huge benefit when we start using fermentation or biotechnology in general, that we can become independent from fossil fuels. The thing is that the global chemical industry really produces on a very, very large scale, right? Mm-hmm. We produce more than 800 million metric tons of base chemicals annually. And if we now think we want to completely shift this chemical industry or these chemical production to being more sustainable, and then we shift all of this to sugar, we run into this problem of this food versus fuel debate, mm-hmm. which is one aspect. The other aspect that I would like to mention is that also when we talk about sustainability, the CO2 emission savings when we switch to sugar as a feedstock, as a raw material, are not necessarily as big as we once believed.
Mm-hmm. Why?
You are heavily dependent on industrial farming, and this also comes with CO2 emissions. Our own analysis shows that sugar-based processes save maximum of 50% of CO2 emissions. Okay. When you compare fossil-based production of a chemical with a sugar-based production, and then you still only accounted for CO2 emissions, mm-hmm. right? So there is much more to sustainability than just that.
Yeah, land use and water use and all this. Yeah.
Exactly. So maybe we can quickly talk about the planetary boundary framework mm-hmm. that was developed by the Stockholm Resilience Center and the team around Johan Rockström. So they have generated or come up with a scientific framework to really quantify the safe operating space of the planet Earth, which we need for sustainable living on this planet as humanity. And as you mentioned, land use, freshwater use are two of these categories. There's also nitrogen and phosphorus usage, mm-hmm. which again, when you look at industrial agriculture, we already breached. And then there is also global biodiversity, which we're not dealing very good in either. So there we also breached this category massively, actually, which in the end then circles back to a problem that we will get in industrial agriculture or in the agricultural industry itself.
Yeah, and then in the end also needed for food, and that is maybe a bit more important than making chemicals. Although we also need those, but yeah, it's always a difficult game to see what is more important. When we need to find the balance or a different source for the carbon, right?
Yeah, that's true, because we do not necessarily need to use plant sugars that we could also use for feeding mm-hmm. Humanity. There is non-food carbon sources that we could use. Glycerol, which is a C3 carbon source that works super well. We can also target agricultural waste, forestry waste. And one that I'm very excited about, we can also use captured climate gases. Mm-hmm.
So CO2 that is captured in a direct air capture plant, for example, or at a point source?
Both work, mm-hmm. yeah. So industrial point sources these days are easier. They have higher CO2 concentrations mm-hmm. Than we have in the air. Yeah. And hence, they are a bit cheaper. Yeah.
Need less energy.
Yeah. There is already an industrial plant built, so you can target this and maybe couple another industrial plant for chemical production next to it.
Mm-hmm. So you use the CO2, and how can you incorporate the CO2 to make chemicals?
Yeah, so there's various different routes to do so. There is indeed actually organisms that can metabolize CO2 itself.
No, oh, okay.
The problem that exists with direct CO2 fermentation is that it's a gas fermentation approach, which is possible. It is just a bit more complicated on an industrial scale compared to liquid fermentation, which is just what we usually mm-hmm. know and which is easier to scale.
Yeah, yeah. I've come across some methanation projects where they used CO2 and hydrogen and then a bioreactor to make methane out of it. But that's then more for fuel and not really to make chemicals. And you, with your research that you also started a company with, you used methanol, right? And why methanol, and how did you get there?
Yeah, methanol in itself can be easily derived from CO2. So you need renewable energy, and then you can produce it completely sustainable. On the other hand, as I just mentioned, the gas fermentation methanol is a liquid. Mm-hmm. So it can be stored more easily, it can be transported more easily, and also you don't have this high explosive risk that you have with methane. And then the more industrial answer to that would be that there is already an industry scaling up green methanol or renewable methanol, which is basically based on the demand of the shipping industry to find new fuels that are sustainable. So Merck, for example, is highly focusing on methanol, already having ships that run on methanol. There's a huge industry push to really upscale the green methanol supply. And then maybe as a last one, because I mentioned the natural CO2 metabolizing bacteria, there is also natural methanol eating microbes.
Oh, okay. So they already know how to use it.
Exactly.
Whereas other intermediate products might be more challenging.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think another point worth mentioning is that China is also investing a lot in the methanol-based chemistry. They mostly doing it with like normal catalytic processes to also become less dependent on the oil. They built their industry on this. So green methanol is scaling definitely. So it's a very interesting idea to use then the biotechnologies to convert that into fine chemicals. And how did you do this? You cannot just use methanol and then throw it on some bacteria and they start eating it, right?
So the way we approach this problem is that we wanted to combine basically the best of two worlds, meaning one, that what I mentioned, that there exist naturally occurring methanol eating microbes, and on the other hand, that we already have bacteria that we use on an industrial scale, as the one that I mentioned from Genomatica. They do have an Escherichia coli, which is the working horse in industrial biotechnology. And then our approach was to combine the two of them and really to basically rewire the E. coli to live on methanol, which has been compared actually to a heart transplantation because it is super complex and it requires a foreign metabolic system going into a new host that natively doesn't really know what to do with it and how to use it. We basically targeted both with the same approach, which is engineering the genome or the DNA of this bacterium, of this E. coli, so that it basically gets trained to first get its carbon and its energy from the methanol, and second, to also completely rewire its whole metabolism around this new energy and carbon source.
So that are multiple processes. It needs to be able to process it, but also it needs to get the energy somewhere. Usually that happens with the sugar, right? And then when it uses sugar, it gets the carbon to whatever it produces from the sugar and the energy, both. Okay.
Yeah. And so what you can do is rationally engineer that E. coli can degrade methanol. For this, what we did is you insert genes from such a species that is a native methylotroph, so that naturally metabolizes methanol, and basically give this toolbox to the E. coli.
Okay. Why can you not use this bacterium directly, the one that already can use methanol?
Yeah, this is a super great question. You can use it to grow on methanol. The problem comes when you want to produce chemicals from it on an industrial scale, because these native methylotrophs are not as well understood as the E. coli is, which probably is the best understood organism that we have on this planet. We have a lot of genetic engineering tools to alter the E. coli and to adapt it to new scenarios and new industrial settings. And we know that it scales very well in these very, very large bioreactors that we need to produce chemicals at the level that we actually need to have a have a shift in the chemical industry. So in theory, yes, you could use a native methylotroph. In practice, there is many, many challenges that you or that we think with an E. coli we can circumvent as soon as the E. coli has learned to metabolize methanol.
And that you did by the genetic modification.
Exactly. So the first step we talked about, which was inserting genes that it can metabolize methanol. The problem is that then basically the cell's internal metabolism is not fully adapted to that.
Okay.
So, and this process is much, much more complicated than just inserting three or four genes, which is also the reason why no one has done that before, and why this is such a long-lasting goal in academia to actually manage to do that. And the approach here at ETH Zurich with the team in the lab was using basically natural selection. So basically using evolution as little helper to make this work.
And you can use that because bacteria, they multiply so fast that you have multiple generations and then, well, there are mutations or how does it work? And
exactly. Then... Yeah. So basically in with every generation, you accumulate new mutation and new mutations just randomly because they happen. Little errors in copying the DNA, which can become very contagious. And then you just need to build basically a laboratory setting around them that you select for the right mutation.
Okay, how can you do that?
Yeah, so the whole process has also a term. It's called adaptive laboratory evolution. And the way you do that is that you have these cells that remember how they can metabolize methanol a little bit, and you keep these cells in really an excess of methanol. So they always have methanol to live off, but you only give them a tiny bit of an additional feedstock. In our case, that was pyruvate, a central metabolite that comes out of the glycolysis. So basically, when you start with sugar, this is what you end up with. And then in this scenario, most cells just die because they don't manage. But those that manage to replicate, as you mentioned, they multiply very fast. And then these random DNA mutations that occur at some point randomly will lead to a beneficial mutation and eventually basically a cell will brew slightly faster than the others and then will outcompete the others. And then what we did is repeating this in a highly controlled bioreactor over hundreds of generations while always keeping this selection pressure on. So always having this huge amount of methanol and very limited central metabolite.
So you basically make an environment where only the cells survive that can live off of methanol because they have so little of their normal food.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. And then you increase their pressure by also giving less and less of the other material?
Yeah, exactly. So as soon as you see a population arising that can deal with the current scenario, you increase the selection pressure and you remove more, or you remove the, in our case, pyruvate to increase the pressure again.
Okay. So you definitely need this selection pressure for something to happen. Because I also, when I read up about this a bit, I was asking myself, when they mutate so much, how can you keep them stable in the end? But then you basically don't have this pressure anymore. You just have your constant methanol environment without the pressure to change anymore. Okay. Yeah, interesting.
Exactly.
So now you have trained the bacteria to live off of methanol, and how do you select what they produce? Because in the end, you want to have some target chemicals and not just a random byproduct.
Yeah, exactly. So after we managed to have the methylotrophic growth, we basically could approach it as every other biotech production problem, which means you continue to engineer the cell, but in the downstream metabolism. Mm-hmm. So for example, what we did was producing lactic acid. And for that, you basically need one additional enzyme for the cell to produce it, which you can easily insert. Mm.
So that is not done by the laboratory evolution, that is done by the old school biotechnology. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Old school. Yeah, so basically what you do, you insert the instruction for how to produce lactic acid into the E. coli. You give it a trigger, and then you can produce it.
Okay, and then when you have the ready bacterium that can live off of methanol and produce, in this case, lactic acid, to make a process out of it, you have to increase the amount it produces as much as possible from the fuel. How is that possible?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So what you can do is you can streamline the metabolism. Also, again, you tweak the DNA a bit. Mm-hmm. You make some enzymes more efficient. And then when you're in a bioreactor, what you can do is you can make the surrounding setting as helpful as possible so that it always has all nutrients at the right time. Mm-hmm. So that it then can produce as efficient as it gets.
What are the metrics that you can change to make the process produce more? Like when you have a given bioreactor and you put your bacterium in there, does it already have enough capacity directly from the point when you started, okay, it can produce the lactic acid now? Or did you have to do other changes to have it in a process, basically?
You still need to adapt it further to produce or to have a higher titer. Mm-hmm.
What is a titer?
It is basically the amount you produce per liter of volume in your bioreactor. Mm-hmm.
And what does have to change there?
One of the challenges to then increase the production of, for example, lactic acid or any other chemical is that in the bioreactor, you need to have basically the perfect environment for the bacteria to be able to produce it, meaning the oxygen transfer rate must be adapted, the nutrients must be adapted. So all the things that this bacteria need to thrive and to have enough basically molecular Lego building blocks then produce specific chemical that you instructed it to produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And to make this bacterium in that way was basically the basis. And then you started with your colleagues Teno BioWorks. What brought you there that you said, oh, now we can actually start a company and it's worth to found a startup? Quick break. If you enjoyed this chemistry content, please consider following Innovate and React on whatever platform you're listening to keep the show in your feed. If you want to do even more, you can tip a one-time amount or become a member of the show with the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes. Thank you for your time, and back to the episode.
Yeah, so I think the very first moment was when actually this evolution experiment generated this methylotrophic E. coli. Mm-hmm. That was a huge eureka moment. And then the second one, more going into the industrial application, where then also this commercialization aspect came into play, was when we transferred the whole concept from shake flasks from the lab into a small bioreactor and seeing that not only the E. coli is thriving, but also the production actually scaled proportionally with the scale of the reactor, so the volume it can live in. So basically that the biology did not collapse, although it was in a different environment, which confirmed for us that actually using this industrial workhorse from which we came from, this whole idea of like really going this tedious long path of teaching E. coli to utilize methanol will work out, because in the first scale-up step, we actually managed to see this increase in production already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basically a good basis. Now, what are your next steps? You scale this process, or how do you go further?
So one of the ongoing steps is for one of the products that we showed in our proof of concept, itaconic acid, to really increase the titer and the productivity. So how much of this chemical we can produce in a certain time.
Mm-hmm. And then show to other customers that they can have basically the same quality and the same product they are used to just from biological pathways.
Yeah, just in a very sustainable method. And then one thing that we also can highlight and that we will test more in the future is that so far the lab work basically is performed with usual gray methanol, so the one that you can just buy from a chemical supplier that supports labs. We had first experiments with green methanol, which looked very promising. And then one of the other things that we were basically claiming to do is that we can also use raw methanol, so that we don't need this last step of purification in the synthesis. Mm-hmm. And also their first experiments indicate that this actually works very well, and that would further down the line help us massively to reduce costs.
Also, if someone can produce green methanol and they don't have to purify it as much to sell it, then this will also be better for them to sell a raw product, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, if the bacteria can use raw methanol, is this in comparison to catalytic process an advantage, or do you think the bacteria can deal better with these impurities?
Yeah, I think they can definitely deal better with the impurities. We have had the list of impurities that they encountered in the experiments that we've done, and we know that there is contaminants that for certain catalysts would have been a huge problem.
No, okay. So it's not only the aspect that you can use green methanol to produce some chemicals, but you can also make the process a bit leaner because you don't need as many purification steps in the middle and thus save costs, probably.
So far, it looks like it, yes.
No, sounds great. Where do you see biotechnology evolving?
So I think that the 21st century actually will be defined by biotechnology and by synthetic biology. We had amazing advancements coming in the recent years. I think CRISPR means something for everyone now, which already in itself is that a biotech or a technology that we use in the lab is so well known. Is very, very exciting for a biotechnologist like me.
Yeah,
and it will implicate healthcare, the food industry, the chemical industry. So I really think that we will make massive progress with biotech. And I think you can also see it reflected in policy papers published around the globe. So Europe last year published their Biotech Act 1, which was mostly focused on healthcare, but the Biotech Act 2 is coming up, where they really want to talk about industrial biotechnology and biomanufacturing. We saw it in China's 5-year plan that was published in spring. They also put biomanufacturing as a strategic national priority. We see it in Japan, we see it in countries in the Middle East. Also, Germany has it on their high-tech agenda as one of the 6 key technologies next to quantum computing and fusion. I think this is all really, really exciting, and I'm super happy to be part of this.
Yeah, definitely a lot of potential there. And where do you see Tenno's role in this? Become a big chemical producer, or how do you see Tenno evolving?
Yeah, so the goal we have is, I think, as you said, it's quite big. It's being the technology provider for chemical production, for chemicals that can be produced using biotechnology. So having this platform technology now where we have this bacterial strain that really can transform basically CO2 via the step of methanol into a variety of products, which we have shown already, with then in the future years of more development of this strain and adaptation to more chemical products, we really want to become this technology provider for also large and small chemical companies around the world.
So provide the technology for other companies to then produce, so not become the producing entity. Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, it always is the problem with large-scale production. You need a lot of steel in the ground, right? And there's already so many large companies that have these industrial plants that have the capacity to do fermentation. And we basically now only need to first train our strain to use the specific product this company wants. And then second, change the production in this plant. And then you make the best use out of what is existing already and what we can bring in as novel technology.
So it could be a drop-in solution where you use the already existing reactors and they can just use your bacteria to produce whatever they want.
Exactly, with a small caveat or with a small challenge that they need to be adapted a little bit for methanol fermentation because most of them will work with sugar or glycerol or other feedstocks. And then with a few adaptations, methanol fermentation is possible. But it's a completely different picture than building a whole new plant.
Yeah, definitely. And another topic that would be interesting for me is you as one of the co-founders of this biotechnology company that will produce chemicals or deals with company that produce chemicals. You really have to be at the intersection of so many different disciplines, biology, chemistry, but also business and finances. How do you manage that?
Yeah, I think first, this is one of the things that excites me most about this whole adventure. Coming out of the science, I think for a scientist, I already had to deal with a lot of different stakeholders during my time as a PhD. Back then, it was scientists out of very different fields, plus clinicians, plus patients. So there is already a very different approach to the same problem. And now I think the challenge is that first we need to translate this quite complex biology into the specific languages of the people. So probably the salesperson of a chemical company doesn't really want to know about adaptive laboratory evolution. They want to know, is it a drop-in chemical? Can I buy it? What is the price? And this is what over the last month was a wonderful learning experience, that people are open, that they are interested, but they want to also know the parameters that are important for them. And this is our task to provide those.
Yeah, it's basically a translator between different worlds. And I think this is really interesting also to interact with so many different disciplines, because back in the days where like everyone was in their own world, like the chemists just had their chemistry problems and the biology people their biology. And yeah, that's really in the recent time that we have to collaborate with as many different people as possible. And then this really brings out new ideas, new technologies, and this can then also impact the future. Then, we can come to an end of this discussion with the closing questions. What is your favorite scientific discovery? Usually I ask about the chemical discovery, but since you're not a chemist, I go for the broader scientific discovery.
Thank you for adapting this. So I love the question because I love to talk about GFP. The abbreviation stands for green fluorescent protein. Mm-hmm. And I think since my first semester in bachelor's, I just love that. Because us biologists, we do use it basically to light up the inside of cells. Mm-hmm. So what you can do is you excite it with a specific wavelength, and then under a fluorescent microscope, you can basically see really inside a living cell. So you can fuse it with a protein of interest, and then you basically can live track the molecular adventure that happens inside the cell. So since my bachelor thesis, I have been fascinated by that. Mm-hmm. And will never forget how it was the first time that I saw this actually happening.
Yeah, that sounds really cool to really see with your own eyes what's happening. Yeah, incredible. I mean, everyone probably knows from school these, when you have a plant cell under a microscope and you see the different organelles, but there you can follow your changes, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Or what do you use the protein for?
Yeah, you can basically investigate very, very specific molecular events mm-hmm. inside this living cell. And I think this is just super fascinating.
Yeah. And it glows.
And it glows. Yeah. That is the cool part. And you can win image competitions with wonderful microscopy.
Oh, cool.
Images with that, which then sometimes can finance your next scientific conference.
That sounds interesting. Yeah. Maybe we can link one of these pictures in the show notes to make that also visible to you. And yeah, I will also link in the show notes the publications from Ronja and her co-workers. And then, thank you for joining me and telling me all about this biotechnology stuff.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Also, thank you very much for listening. Check out the show notes for fluorescence microscope images and the links to the publications. If you would like to talk about your research in the podcast, contact me via email to contact@innovateandreact.com or connect with me on LinkedIn. Until next time, keep innovating and stay curious.